All right, this meeting of the House Community and Regional Affairs will now come to order. It is 8:04 a.m., Thursday, April 27, 2023, in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Vice Chair McCabe, Representative McKay, Representative Ruffridge, Representative Hinshut, Representative Mears, and myself, Representative McCormick, Chair. Representative Pawtucket, I believe, has an excused absence this morning. We're also joined in the audience by Representative Stutz, and we also have Representative Sumner and Representative Groh as well. Oh, and Representative Coulomb, who I think are all here to present. So, nonetheless, let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. And your Apple Watch, because it happens sometimes. Before we begin, I would like to thank Linda Jensen, the House CNRA Secretary for Records, and Jake Wade from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. And I'd also like to thank my committee aide, Mina Ryan, for being the committee aide as well. Today we will be hearing three bills. First up is House Bill 133 by Representative Sumner, exempting Municipal Service Area Board meetings. Second, we will have a second hearing of House Bill 134 by Rep. Coulomb, relating to property transfer tax, and we'll be having public testimony for that. And then third, we will, if time allows, hear House Bill 153 by Rep. Groh, relating to oil and gas property tax. First up is House Bill 133 with Representative Sumner and Stephen Ard, staff to Rep. Sumner. Please come forward, put yourself on the record, and give us an introduction to your legislation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 133 would give specific exemptions to local municipalities for the Open Meetings Act. Currently, the Open Meetings Act, or OMA, doesn't allow for board supervisors on road safety and assessment boards to even ride in the same vehicle because of the quorum statute in the Open Meetings Act. For example, the Matsu Borough RSA is an advisory-only position appointed by the mayor. These positions are strictly voluntary with no power to contract or spend borough money. Not only would this change incentivize local board members, which there's been a large problem filling these positions in the Matsu Valley. It would also be critical to get all the supervisors together and brainstorm on how to best solve borough issues without the cloud of the OMA. Currently, in practice, if a board member found out something that there was an issue with the road, he or she does not have the ability to call others on the board to come and look at the problem and discuss solutions on solving the issue because of the Open Meetings Act. This is a big problem for local municipalities with an easy solution set forth in this bill. So I ask that you please support us in House Bill 133. Chief of Staff, Steve Menard, can run through the sectional analysis, and we do have invited testimony, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, Steve Menard, Chief of Staff, Representative Sumner. This is a very simple bill. A little under the weather. In Section 1, it's a grammatical amendment to AS 44-62-310-D5 from upon to on, and removes a portion of AS 44-62-310-D8 to ultimately read meetings of municipal services area boards established under AS 2935450. This is the heart of the bill that will give the power back to local municipalities to function reasonably in deciding on how best to problem solve and not to be in violation of the Open Meetings Act. And then Section 2 is just simply changing the effective date clause. And just for the record, we do have Jill Parsons, who sits on the Borough Advisory Board, and Mookie Toes, who's on the Borough Assembly, listening in. And we'd take questions if you have any.
Are there any questions? Ms. Parson, I'll also afford you the opportunity to speak to this bill if you'd like to.
Well, Yes, I would. My name is Jill Parson. I'm on the RSA 21 Big Lake Board of Supervisors, and we are significantly impacted by the Open Meetings Act. And while it says all our meetings are open to the public, practically that doesn't work when observing road conditions is the reason for meeting, and site visits often are spontaneous and weather dependent. And my experience is this. Two times per year, our Board of Supervisors joins our public works staff to drive around the road service area to visit problem areas and discuss possible solutions. This is an educational and fact-finding trip. There's no recommendations or decisions made at this point. In the per the OMA, it must be a published meeting, whether or not we have any public attending, and we end up driving in 3 to 5 separate cars so that we do not have a quorum of our 5-member board in any one vehicle that can exclude the public. Then at each road, we get out of our vehicles, observe the issues, minimize our discussions to continue our very long day's observations. Ideally, if all 5 of us can drive in one van with our public works staff, we can discuss issues and evaluate alternatives in between stops, a valuable and efficient way to find solutions to our road problems. Then we can be prepared with alternatives to present to our public at our regularly scheduled monthly meetings in which the public participates, and then we can make our recommendations. 3 weeks ago, a ride around was canceled due to 4 inches of new snowfall, and ideally we should have been able to say, let's reschedule next week. But OMA meeting notices require a longer time to post, so we will miss that 2 to 3 week window where our roads are in their worst condition for our fact-finding visit and delay our recommendations for the upcoming construction season for at least 1 month.
Thank you, Ms. Parson. Are there any questions for Ms. Parson? Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. First off, thank you for serving in this capacity. I know that a lot of the work that folks do, especially on a topic like checking out on infrastructure, is very unappreciated, but it is pretty important. Having done a lot of site visits to different types of projects in my career, that time that you are traveling between sites can be a very productive time for conversation, and I look forward to supporting this bill. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Vice Chair McCabe.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. So this has been a problem in the Big Lake RSA for years. We have 110 miles of road. It's about impossible for 3 people to do it, but they limited the board for a number of years to 3 people for this reason, because the 3 of them could get together. But it became such a monumental task. They had to increase the number of people on the board, and it ran them afoul of this. Personally, I think they're taking it maybe a little too literally, the Open Meetings Act, but in the interest of protecting the public. I mean, if one of them walks into the Big Lake Diner and there's already 3 of them there eating, he doesn't go in because of the Open Meetings Act, even though they're sitting at different tables and they're not talking about roads. Because I think the law assumes, or when the makers of this statute assume, that anytime they get together, if they got a common interest, they're going to be talking about it, right? So I think this goes a long way. The RSA boards don't have any fiduciary, can't spend any money. It all has to go through the assembly. All they really do is talk about, roads and make recommendations. So the ultimate authority for the spend comes from the assembly, if I'm not mistaken. I think Jesse's trying to correct me, but...
Representative Sumner.
Through the chair, it may seem like the Matsu Borough is taking the Open Meetings Act too seriously, but I believe we may be the only municipality that has a standing injunction for violations of the Open Meetings Act, and so we kind of have to take it seriously. So, thank you.
Hello?
Yes, please.
Yeah, so I get that. I mean, I totally understand the legal and the wrangling and the watchdogs, if you will. So I don't think this law was ever intended to prevent more than three borough members from attending a Republican Women's fundraiser or an NRA function or something like that, but they have to take it literally because they've sort of been forced to. So this will go a long way towards helping us with our road situation. And I think there is some intent to increase the size of the road service area boards in different RSA districts to kind of follow the Big Lake model of five people, if they can find the people to do it. And currently they can't because of these kinds of restrictions. So that's a long-winded way of saying I'm for this one.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair McCormick, and through the chair to the bill sponsor. Would it be the intent, I guess, of the bill to exempt municipal service area boards for every meeting, essentially meaning that the service area board could meet essentially whenever, however, in secret, if they wanted to make up what I want to make sure that a service area board still has some sort of mechanism to say have a public meeting, I guess. What would prevent them from just having all their meetings behind closed doors?
So through the chair, we did bring the bill that way, you know, as a bare bones approach to this. I think that it would not be problematic for these service area boards to be excluded from the Open Meetings Act, although we would, I believe, consider it a friendly amendment if the board would like to put some side rails on this. Our committee would like to put some side rails on this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Follow up? Representative Hemshue.
I think, thank you, through the chair. I had a similar question. I'll just rephrase it a different way. if they travel together in a van and they look at the issue and they discuss, what then is the public process that's followed in the decision making? We don't have a lot of roads, so this is a whole new thing for me. So they come back in the van, and do they then make recommendations to the assembly, and there's a public discussion that's been noticed at the assembly level?
Through the chair, I think it would be difficult for them to, outside of a public meeting, actually pass a resolution to send to the assembly with recommendations. So we, at least, I don't believe we're envisioning secret meetings that generate resolutions to send the assembly, but maybe that they could go on fact-finding missions and the like without the OMA's restrictions preventing that, and then at some point they would then have a meeting. But I'm not even sure that it would be problematic to completely exclude them from the OMA. I mean, it is the assembly that ultimately has the purse strings and is accountable to the public. So,
and if I may, through the chair, the vital point of this bill is local control. So the assembly will be able to set the parameters of when they can meet, what they can discuss, when it comes back for display in the public forum. So it's vital that we all believe that local control is has the authority, and that's what this bill will do. Thank you.
Vice Chair McCabe.
Thanks. And so, Representative Sumner, I believe you probably know this best, but the borough code sets the timing and the dates for RSA required meetings, right? I think once a month, and I can't remember, if I think it's the second Tuesday at 6 or something like that. I've been to dozens and dozens of them. So, but that's all set out in borough code, if I'm not mistaken, right? So, I mean, even if they got together in a van a couple times a week, it would still be a required public meeting where the public could attend in the open transparency. If I'm not mistaken, is that maybe that's a better as a question?
So through the chair, I think we'd be trying to exclude the public from all piling into the van for that. but the meeting where they actually discuss the policy recommendations to send to the assembly would still be a public meeting. At least the way I would envision it. And I think that local governments could set that out in code without sort of the overbearing restriction that the OMA has created here. Thank you.
Follow-up?
I'm good.
Okay. Representative Mears, did you have a... No, you did not. Okay. I see we have someone else on for testimony. Moki Tu is... Okay. Mr. Tu, or if you'd like to provide your testimony, please go right ahead.
Okay, through the chair, this is Moki Tu, T-E-W. I'm a Mat-Su Borough Assembly member, and I'm going to speak on this subject. It has been very hinders the operation of the road superintendent, the RSA supervisors, to respond when the citizens call and they say, we have problems out here on this road. It makes it a problem for more than one of them to go out and look at the problem on the road and then report back to the Mat-Su Borough Road superintendent what the problem is, what may be a result in fixing it. This has no, there's no intention of not having the public on the meeting. The Mat-Su Borough says that the RSA must have a meeting quarterly. So that means it can go for quarters. What else? Let's see. So in the wintertime when they have a snow event and the road supervisors are called, right now they can only basically go out by themselves and look at it, but they might want to have somebody else help them go look and see what the problems are, to make sure that the roads are being plowed properly, that the cul-de-sacs are being done, so forth and so on. And then they're allowed, so they actually are like an arm of the borough to help with monitoring. So it's wonderful. And then in the summer, the same time that citizens may call, and they have a problem with something, this would allow the superintendents to get to, or supervisors to get together and look at the problem and be able to come up with some kind of solution. And the same time in the spring when we have flooding, they can go out and look at the, when it's actually flooding, how it's going down the road and make a plan. Now, no one is trying to get away with not having the public involved. The public is coming to the meeting, but what this does is this allows the road supervisors, the volunteer people that put out a lot of time to do this stuff, knowledge, so when they go in there, they can talk about this subject and then hopefully come up with a solution. And then the road supervisors, which are the volunteer people, have no ability to spend money or direct work or direct the contractors to work. But in this body, when they have a meeting, this is when solutions come. That's when the solutions are formulated and put together. Allowing volunteers to communicate like this builds a much stronger team of people. We have a hard time in some of these places to get volunteers, and it has a lot to do with this open meeting act where they can't never talk together. They're not allowed to talk. They have to sit back and wait for a meeting. And like I said, sometimes that could be quarterly. So basically you end up with no people in those positions, or just one person in a position, and that's the volunteer road supervisor position. So this would make it a much stronger team if we could get rid of this Open Meetings Act for the people to actually communicate, feel that their voice matters, their opinion matters, their time matters. I think that... I think this is a very, very big, this would go a long way in helping out all the RSAs and creating a much better environment and a much better community and much better unity amongst our community. So I don't know what else to say. If you have a specific question, maybe I can answer for you. But I think I kind of laid it out what I think.
Thank you very much for providing your testimony this morning, Mr. Tu. Are there any questions for Mr. Tu? Hearing none, thank you very much for coming to speak with us this morning. Are there any other questions or remarks from members of the committee? Representative Mears.
Thank you, Representative Sumner, through the chair. I was just curious if you had reached out to other areas of the state outside of the Matsu Valley area to ask if there were similar issues or questions that they had on the topic.
Through the chair, Representative Muir, we have not. This was brought as a specific problem in the Matsu Valley, but I'm sure if you look around the state on an advisory board level, this problem occurs because of the worry of the open meetings violation. And I think it's not to hammer at home, but anytime we're asking the public on a voluntary basis, as you well know, our most valuable thing is time, to give up their time for the community. This just kind of empowers them. So to answer your question, we have not. But if you feel that we need to, we would.
Thank you. Follow up?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I think having one of the advantages of having a diverse geographic group of folks here in the legislature is we've got the opportunity to have some of those conversations as well. So I think some of us will be doing that, and I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Sumner, did you have any comments you wanted to make before we set this aside?
No, but I do appreciate the opportunity to present the bill to you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you very much for presenting today. HB 133 will be held over. We will now go at ease while we transition to our next bill. Would Representative Coulombe and Maggie Elliott, staff to Representative Coulombe, please come forward? And we'll get going. Brief at ease. All right, we are now back on the record. Representative Coulombe, would you be kind enough to just give us a brief recap of 134 before we get into invited testimony?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So good morning, Chair McCormick, Vice Chair McCabe, and members of the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. So HB 134 will prohibit municipalities and state government from imposing tax transfers on buying and selling of a home, of homes or real property. Right now, the bill is preemptive. This is not anything that would eliminate existing taxes. It does not affect the ability for municipalities to deal with their disclosure, whether it's involuntary or voluntary. This is just to prevent the ability to tax the transfer of real property. And as I said in the meeting, the first hearing, one of the reasons why I wanted to carry this bill is because in Anchorage, we have seen the effects of the housing crunch throughout the state. And I don't see this particular area of housing as separate silos in the state. We're all connected. It's all interconnected. And that's why I thought it was important that we make sure that government's not making a bad problem worse by adding transfer taxes onto it. So I believe in local control, but in this area of housing, I really feel like the problem is a statewide problem. The solution is statewide solutions, and this is why I feel it's important to make sure that this doesn't make the problem worse.
Thank you, Representative Coulombe. So I have a list of invited testifiers here. Would you like me to just go down the list, or did you have maybe if you wanted to call up someone, if you had a particular order you were interested in?
Thank you, Chair. I don't have any particular order. You can just go down the list.
All right. Then in that case, I will turn now to Riley Bodyselt from Fairbanks. You state your name for the record. Provide your testimony.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair and Representative. I would like to start by thanking the committee for their time and commitment to serving the people in the state of Alaska. My name is Riley Bodyselt, and I'm a realtor at Summer Sotheby's International Realty in Fairbanks and currently serve as the president-elect of the Greater Fairbanks Board of Realtors. I'm also a proud military spouse and certified military relocation professional. As many of you know, Alaska is home to several military bases. Fairbanks alone has two bases that are vital to our economy. Military personnel stationed in Alaska often face unique challenges when it comes to finding housing when they make the move to our beautiful state. One of the benefits of being in the military is the ability to move frequently and relocate to different parts of the country or even the world. Military members who are stationed in Alaska may need to buy or sell real estate quickly, and additional fees or taxes can create an undue burden on them. House Bill 134 is an act prohibiting municipalities in the state from levying a tax on the transfer of real property and relating to municipal taxation of mobile telecommunication services. Some of the greatest experiences of my career are helping military members and families make the move here. I love to introduce them to our community and help them find a place to call home. I love watching them call Alaska home while they're here and helping them sell when it's time to leave, making it possible for them to purchase a home in the next place that they get to call home. This is why we need House Bill 134. On the other side of that, some of the most gut-wrenching experiences in my career have been helping clients that are not able to find affordable housing here. Right now, due to a lack of housing on and off Alaska Air Force Base, if housing cannot be secured by the military member, their families cannot join them. This is why we really need House Bill 134. Our state's remote location and limited housing supply already makes it difficult for military members to find affordable housing. The added cost of a transfer fee or tax can make it even harder for military families to buy or sell their homes in Alaska. We really need House Bill 134. Imposing a transfer fee or tax on real estate transactions in Alaska would have a negative impact on military families who are already facing unique challenges when it comes to finding affordable housing. It would make it more difficult for them to buy and sell real estate in the state. Therefore, I encourage you to approve House Bill 134 and fight to keep housing affordable in Alaska. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Were there any questions that members had? Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you, through the chair. I appreciate you calling in. My family's military service is a generation ago, and so my question is, don't military families have programs that help them with buying and selling homes? I thought there was something to make it easier because they do have to transfer so much. I thought that there was federal assistance to buy out a home that doesn't sell, or are they really on their own?
There are programs to help military families buy and sell homes, most commonly the VA loan, but it does require them to, I mean, they have to be able to afford it.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Well, thank you very much again for your testimony this morning. Next, we will turn to Barbara Ngayak. If you could state your name for the record, and go ahead and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Barbara Ngayak. I reside in Homer, and I am a retired teacher. I speak today in favor of House Bill 134. The cost of living in our state, as we know, is already high. Affordable housing is a huge factor for families and in our ability to attract and retain employees in all sectors, whether they are public or private. We are definitely in a public sector employment crisis due to a number of factors. Adding to the problem will not help. Housing is a serious issue in almost every community in Alaska. Added fees on top of already skyrocketing prices causes more problems. In Homer, two newly hired teachers for next school year were offered contracts not only because they are highly qualified, but because they are already colleagues in another school. It is hoped that they will have a good chance to find affordable housing as possible roommates. Buying in Homer will be nearly impossible, even if they pool their resources. Two additional examples of why added fees to real estate sales are not good are, first, we moved to Homer 6 years ago. We sold our home in Bethel after living there for over 40 years. The single mother who purchased our home had been saving up to buy a house. She had almost enough for a down payment, but had to borrow from family to have enough. She now houses herself, her three children, the oldest of whom is married, her daughter-in-law, and a grandchild. Multi-generational families live in one home, and this is not uncommon in rural towns and villages. If she had had to come up with an additional even 1% on top of what she was already paying, she would not have been able to house herself or her family. A second example is my own daughter and son-in-law, who lived in a small townhouse in Anchorage. They found out they were expecting a baby, which we were all thrilled about, but they needed more room. They found a forever home and were able to purchase it, but couldn't have if the price had been higher due to additional fees. Please, I urge you to move House Bill 134 out of committee and support its passage. If you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Does anyone have any questions for Ms. Angayak? Hearing none, we'll go ahead and move on, but thank you again for your testimony. Next, we have Mark Maisley from Anchorage. If you could state your name for the record, you can go ahead and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Maisley, M-A-S-L-E-Y, and I am a realtor with RE/MAX Dynamic Properties here in Anchorage, Alaska. And I'm calling today to support House Bill 134. I believe that this bill is critical for the future of home ownership in Alaska. As you've heard from many other people that have testified to this, we are facing an affordable housing crisis across Alaska, and it's a pressing issue that affects many Alaskans. I understand that this bill is a peremptory bill. But the disclosure of real estate sales prices across the country has been a precursor to levying a transfer tax on housing transactions in 36 states already. We must not follow this path, as it would further exacerbate the lack of affordable housing across our state. The potential for a transfer tax could harm current and future homeowners, particularly first-time home buyers who are already facing rising interest rates, rising property taxes, and significant financial challenges that are affecting their ability to purchase a home. Also, our senior citizens that are often on fixed incomes and dependent on selling their home to fund their retirement years could be significantly impacted by a transfer tax. With many seniors relying on the equity in their homes to cover living and healthcare expenses, the added cost of a transfer tax could make it more difficult for them to maintain their financial security in their golden years. The National Association of Realtors predicts that this vulnerable group will represent over 42% of home sellers in 2023. House Bill 134 will help ensure the ability to own a home remains a reality for all Alaskans, regardless of age or income. By prohibiting the imposition of transfer taxes on real property, we can help alleviate the financial challenges faced by potential homeowners and ensure the growth and stability of our communities. I urge you to stand with Alaska's family and seniors, support House Bill 134, and make a lasting positive impact on the lives of our fellow citizens. Together, we can protect the dream of home ownership and ensure that this vital aspect of the Alaskan way endures for generations to come. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony this morning. Are there any questions? Seeing none, we'll move right along. Next, we have Excuse me, let me make sure they're on the iPad here. Next, we have Larry Burke from Anchorage. Mr. Burke, if you could state your name for the record.
Good morning.
Go ahead and provide your testimony.
Yes, good morning. My name is Larry Burke. I am the immediate past president of Alaska Realtors. I'm also the owner of Century 21 Realty Solutions. I have five offices with over 60 licensees in Anchorage, Homer, Soldotna, Eagle River, and Palmer. So I represent a few people within our industry, and the transfer tax is sometimes known as a deed tax or mortgage registry tax or stamp tax. And transfer taxes, just so everybody knows, are separate from recording and mortgage recording taxes, and they could add anywhere from 1 to 3% to the closing costs, which these taxes are not tax deductible on your federal taxes. So this really came up with an issue that happened in Juneau, where consumers experienced firsthand when privacy rights were encroached by the city and borough, requiring disclosure of property sales price, which in turn they did not have a great response, so they started issuing a $50 a day fine for not disclosing it. So this, and the disclosure sales price always leads to a transfer tax, which was previously addressed by another member. So I would just like to urge the committee to move House Bill 135 out of committee and allow a vote on this this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Burke. Seeing no questions, we will move on to Callie Bacon. If you could go ahead, state your name for the record, you can go ahead and provide your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Callie Bacon. I'm a resident of Seward, Alaska. I work as the associate broker here at Seward Properties. I've been in real estate for 9 years here, since 2014. I'm here today to voice my support for House Bill 134. A transfer tax on the sale of real estate would be harmful to the residents of rural Alaska. 75% of the buyers that my office serves are local residents of Seward who are buying a primary residence. 45% of all the buyer clients we served in 2022 were first-time home buyers. Affordability is already a challenge for my clients. The people in rural communities like Seward cannot afford a real estate transfer tax. Home prices in Seward have climbed in recent years. Housing inventory is at historic lows. Affordability is already a huge concern across rural communities. People here do not pay cash for real estate. Most buyers use a home loan with just 5% down. Adding even a 1% transfer tax at closing would add $4,000 in closing costs to the sale of an average home in Seward. Even if a transfer fee is called a seller cost, the reality is it's partially carried by buyers in the form of sellers wanting a higher sales price or other concessions. The people of rural communities like Seward cannot afford a transfer tax. On behalf of rural community residents around the state, I oppose the transfer tax on real estate, and I would encourage you to support the passage of House Bill 134 and move it out of committee. This bill should be heard by the full body, as it is the impact of imposing real estate taxes would be detrimental statewide. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony this morning, Ms. Bacon. Seeing no questions, we will move on to Terry Bryan. If you could state your name for the record, you can go ahead and provide your testimony.
Good morning. I'm Terry Bryan, a 45-year resident of Alaska, and have been a member of the real estate industry for 30 of those years. Currently, I am the division president of Stewart Title Insurance Company, and I've been an owner of a statewide title agency with 10 offices around the state, and am the past president of the two largest title insurance and real estate underwriters within the state of Alaska. In those capacities, I've been involved in tens of thousands of real estate transactions. Title companies per se will not be directly impacted by the implementation of transfer fees, but I may not professionally have a dog in this fight. However, as a citizen and being very knowledgeable of multiple real estate transactions, I would like to speak briefly in support of HB 134, the implementation of transfer fees, taxes, and particularly different structures throughout the state of Alaska would negatively impact the flow of commerce. Adding any additional expense to homeownership will frequently force many first-time homebuyers out of the market. It also will increase the expense that would negatively impact the ability of many of your constituents in reference to transferring, selling, buying homes. During these current and future economic times, we should do all we can do to support and protect the Alaskan consumers and not adding additional expense. Not to speak of potentially adding different fee structures and different levels of fees throughout the state of Alaska, different jurisdictions would create an unlevel playing field within the state of Alaska. One jurisdiction may have one fee, another jurisdiction have something dramatically different. You know, a family may be forced to not live in the community they choose to, close to work and family, due to these arbitrary fee structures that could eventually be established. This would be a disparity in the treatment of Alaskans and not the Alaskan way. As we all know, the real estate industry is a key economic force within the state of Alaska. We should be looking at ways to support the Alaskans and to ensure our growth, not to impede or handicap the path to home ownership. HB 134 does that. It does not impede or protects the consumer and the marketplace. I personally and professionally support HB 134 and the young couples looking to buy a home. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Seeing no questions, I believe that's all the invited testimony that we have, unless there's anyone that we missed or maybe someone in the room. No?
Thank you, Chair. There's no one in the room.
Okay, right now. Great. Thank you very much, everyone who called in to provide invited testimony this morning. We'll move on now to public testimony. Just so everyone's aware, each testifier will have 2 minutes. I don't see a lot of public testimony, so I'll be a little lenient with time, I think. So we'll now open public testimony for HB 134. Our first testifier is Nils Andresen. You could state your name for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Hi. Thank you, Chair. This is Nils Andreasen. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. I appreciate the committee's attention to this issue this morning and the opportunity for public testimony. I think what I heard from many of the invited testifiers is a concern for housing costs in Alaska. I don't know that this bill addresses those. General sales taxes do not apply to residential sales by existing homeowners under the standard exception for casual or isolated sales. At the same time, the lack of definition within the bill doesn't clearly help us clarify what a transfer is applied to and would require a definition of transfer to be applicable. Right now, the bill is structured to apply to all sales taxes and use taxes. Use tax is also not currently defined in law and would need a definition, but it may not apply just to the transfer of that property, and there's some concern that there's not clarity around its encompassing real estate agents' services, the title insurance necessary to transfer the property, the closing escrow services, the purchase of mortgage points, appraisal services, and so on. And that ambiguity changed this bill from a bill looking for a problem, since there aren't transfer taxes currently common in the state, I'm only aware of one, to one that's maybe very definitely affecting all local governments who have a sales tax that's lawfully applied under the Constitution. So I express real concern about the ambiguity of the bill, its effect on local governments, and really its intent to address the housing crisis that Alaskans are facing. I would encourage this committee to spend time on that housing crisis. I think there's an opportunity to really dig into where our costs And I know that when this came up for healthcare, the legislature acted by implementing the Alaska Healthcare Price Transparency Law. And something similar for real estate would really drive us toward better accountability and understanding of costs involved in housing. There are many other costs involved in the housing considerations that I think this committee could look at and help to address. And AML is fully supportive of Alaskans working together to ensure affordable, accessible housing for residents. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony this morning, Mr. Andreasen. Next, we have Tanya Moser from Juneau. Ms. Moser, provide your name, or excuse me, put your name on the record. You have 2 minutes.
Hi, my name is Tanya Moser. I am a resident of Juneau, Alaska, a retired teacher and current real estate agent here in Juneau. And I'm calling in to give my full support for House Bill 134. I disagree with our previous speaker that affordable housing is, that this won't affect that. I understand his intent, but my question or concern is if we add another tax to an already expensive transaction, we will definitely make housing more unaffordable than it already is. And I think a point that I'd like to make is that we're putting an undue burden on a very small percentage of people. This isn't just like a sales tax on food that might be evenly distributed in a town. In June of last year, we had a pretty big housing year, and we sold 290 homes. That's less than 5% of all of the homes in Juneau. And if there had been a transfer tax, it would have been placed solely on that 5% of people. So I would just like to ask you to please register my support for House Bill 134 and work towards positive solutions for affordable housing. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning, Ms. Moser. So I believe that that's all we have for public testimony. So I will now close public testimony for House Bill 134. Representative Coulomb, did you have any closing comments?
No, I thank the committee for hearing the bill. I appreciate your time and effort. And just one thing in reference to the caller talking about definitions, we do have statutory definitions for transfer and real property, and we can give that to the committee.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments for Representative Coulomb? No? Representative Coulomb, Ms. Elliott, thank you very much for your presentation this morning. We will set House Bill 135 aside. 134 will be held over. I apologize. We will take a brief at ease while we transition. Brief at ease. All right, we are now back on the record. I'd like to welcome Representative Groh and staff to Representative Groh, Cameron Ebersold. Please put your name on the record and introduce your legislation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Cliff Groh. I represent House District 18 in North Anchorage, and with me is...
Cameron Ebersold, staff to Representative Cliff Groh.
As I said, thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this legislation. I appreciate the committee's time and attention. The budget passed this year has a $580 million imbalance, and we face a structural deficit that very soon will run between $1 billion and $2 billion each year. The combined balance of the Constitutional Budget Reserve and the Statutory Budget Reserve is $8.7 billion lower than in 2015, even though our operating budget is $1.1 billion lower than it was in 2015. Folks, we need new revenues, and this bill, House Bill 153, provides one option to gain new revenues. House Bill 153 proposes to increase the maximum mill rate from 20 mills, which is 2%, to 30 mills, which is 3%, on the full and true value of oil and gas property assessed under Alaska Statute 43 56. Currently, the total the mill rate is capped at 20 mills. Municipalities may set their tax rates to collect taxes up to that amount. The state retains the property tax revenues that are not otherwise collected by municipalities. So the state's collections under this tax fall each time a municipality raises its property tax rate. Under this bill, the maximum municipal tax rate would remain at 20 mills, leaving local communities harmless. But the state, under this bill, would tax an additional 10 mills that would generate revenue reserved for the state of Alaska. House Bill 153 offers a fixed and predictable cost for the oil and gas industry and a stable revenue source for the state. House Bill 153 will not solve our structural deficit, but it is definitely a step in the right direction.
Thank you for your presentation, Representative Groh. Are there any questions or comments before I believe we'd move into sectional analysis?
Sure.
Yeah, please go right ahead.
And I'd ask Mr. Ebersold to do that, please.
Yeah, again, Cameron Ebersold, again, through the chair, sectional analysis. Section 1 amends Alaska Statute 4356-10A to include a new subsection that increases the maximum mill rate an additional 10 mills. This only applies to taxable property defined under Alaska Statute 4356-210. Section 2 amends 4356-10D with conforming language. It clarifies the municipal property tax under A1 of the bill can only be credited to the taxpayer. And the estimated section 3, the estimated balance of the taxes collected in this section of the bill may be appropriated by the legislature as follows. 1, 50% to the Alaska Capital Income Fund, 2, 25% to the Department of of Education and Early Development for early childhood education programs, including pre-elementary programs, childcare, and education programs, and 3, 25% to the Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund. And Section 4 establishes an effective date, January 1st, 2024.
Thank you, Mr. Ebersold. Are there any questions or comments? Vice Chair McCabe.
Thank you. And through the chair, Representative Groh, doesn't this establish, if you will, a dedicated fund, which is not constitutional? It says, the fiscal note says it directs. It says property tax revenue increase is shown as designated general fund, but this bill directs the legislature to appropriate revenue as follows. 50% into the Alaska Capital Income Fund, 25% to the Department of Education and Early Development for specified programs, and 25% into the Alaska Higher Education Fund. Maybe technically it doesn't, but in spirit, this sort of violates what our Constitution says we're not supposed to do, which is basically earmark monies to go into specific funds, right?
Thank you, Mr. Representative McCabe, and through the chair. Section 3 of the bill reads, the annual estimated balance of the account may be appropriate by the legislature. So that would be consistent with the constitutional language that you're referencing, Representative McCabe. And I guess it's best seen, this language in the legislation is best seen as aspirational, given the constitutional restriction and prohibition of dedication of funds.
Thank you.
Follow-up?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. Through the chair, to Representative Groh. I would be interested to note what the effective tax rate would be by state, particularly those states who have a large amount of oil and gas production. So resource states, we could think of Texas or Oklahoma, North Dakota. I know oftentimes this is a competitive market in some cases. It seems like it's a market that Alaska hasn't exactly been winning in for a while. Feels like North Dakota might be an area in which, we've lost some business to in recent memory. And I am familiar with the fact that North Dakota has no property tax on oil and gas. Are you familiar with what other states do as far as oil and gas production goes, their effective tax rates for oil and gas property, as well as production taxes, and where Alaska ranks in the in those states.
Thank you, Representative Rufford. Through the chair, there are a mix of taxes, as you note, that various states have. I don't have a precise ranking. I do perceive and understand that there's some room to raise some revenues here. I think that that's the kind of question that might also be germane in another committee. I hope that this could get referred to, and I'm obviously happy to provide a ranking. I do think that this should be seen in terms of the overall, overall, like I said, package of taxes that are on the oil and gas industry. As I said, I believe that there's some room here for the state to generate more revenues. We haven't, in fact, changed this tax rate since it was initially enacted in 1973. And I do think, as I said, that there are some revenues that the state could obtain here. But I do think, and I would be happy to work to get, especially for another committee, that ranking that you're asking for.
Follow up? Please, yeah, thank you. And it's probably more of a comment, but the, I think the concern here is that Alaska, being a state with abundant resources, we've clearly had a lot of energy and effort put into this session to try to overcome some of the barriers in order to produce some of those resources. I worry that we would put ourselves at a competitive disadvantage consistently in this industry if we were always at that highest tax rate, when there's other states in the union who don't even tax property on oil and gas at all, and then we have a consideration for raising property tax. We're at risk of continuing the exodus of companies that want to do work in Alaska. So that's I think my large concern with this topic. So just wanted to put that out there for the record. Thank you.
Representative McKay.
Thanks. So Representative Grill,
sorry about that.
Yeah, no worries. We're going to fight over
it. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for interrupting Mr. McKay.
I apologize. I thought you raised your hand first. Was I wrong?
It's okay. Well, I just want to completely agree with my colleague from Soldotna, and thank Representative Grove for bringing forth his ideas for new revenues. I think that the concept needs a lot of study. My first question I agree with my colleague from Big Lake that we need to look at the constitutionality of dedicated funds. That could be a big, big flaw with the bill. We also need to look at how this would affect the boroughs where our primary production takes place, which is the North Slope Borough and the Kenai Peninsula Borough. What impact this would have on continued investment in the state. As everyone, I think, should know, we're having a heck of a time attracting investment up here, and anything we do to make that more difficult is a problem for me, that's for sure. Just to put some real numbers on it, it says here that you think you could raise $250 million a year in new revenue under this bill. We need, in Cook Inlet alone, we need 15 new gas wells drilled every year from point forward to maintain 70 billion cubic feet per year of gas production to power the rail belt. And until renewables actually prove themselves as being something that we could really rely on, that's going to continue to be the case. So we really need to incentivize gas well drilling in Cook Inlet. 15 wells a year at an average of $10 million per well is $150 million investment we need every year in Cook Inlet just for the gas. So if this would take a bite out of that investment, we need to be very careful about that, and I think this would need significant study. A senior senator in the other body mentioned to the media the other day that a sales tax would need 2 years of study. And I would say that a proposal like this would need an equal amount of consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, and through the chair to Representative McKay, I want to first clarify an implication here. It's and restate that this is a matter of revenues, municipal revenues. This absolutely holds the local governments harmless, and there's no effect on the property tax revenues that they get under this tax. The second aspect of this, in terms of effects on local governments or local communities in other ways, that might be best addressed, personally I understand, is on the line here, Niels Andreessen, the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League, and I would ask if the chair could ask him to address that, please.
Mr. Andreessen, if you'd like to speak to that.
Yeah, thank you. For the record, Niels Andreessen, executive director of Alaska Municipal League, and I can't speak more broadly to the economic impacts of the bill, but I can clarify that the bill is currently drafted doesn't change existing law as it relates to local government collection of property tax as it applies to oil and gas property.
Thank you.
Through the chair, I understand that. I just concerned about the money that we'd be taking out of the private sector from the oil industry that would otherwise be used to drill new wells and give us new production that is the largest single revenue producer that we could hope for. So that would be my major concern with this bill.
Vice Chair McCabe.
Thank you, Chairman McCormick. So, Representative Groh, this has nothing to do with production. This is simply land. So if the oil companies, I mean, this is property tax, right? So they could own a non-producing well or a capped well or some sort of a, you know, we're going to set this aside well until, because it's not very economical for us to, pump oil or gas from it right now. We'll save it for later. They could make all those kind of financial decisions and we would still be taxing them even though it wasn't any kind of, so it's not tied to production whatsoever. This is simple property tax, right?
Through the chair, Mr. Representative McCabe, that's correct. And it taxes, and I'm going to disclose some experience here. I used to be, it's previously served as a lawyer for a law firm that represented the city of Valdez. And so I have participated as a lawyer in both administrative proceedings and litigation involving this tax over the years. And oil and gas properties include things like drilling equipment, the pipeline itself, the terminal is a big source of value that is taxed, as well as obviously the entire pipeline. But I do think that that question could also be better addressed to the actual administrator of this tax. I understand that Colleen Glover, the director of the tax division of the Department of Revenue, is also online, and I would ask the chair to ask her to address that, please.
Ms. Glover, if you would please address that, if you're, can you hear us okay?
Good morning, yeah, Colleen Glover, tax division director. For the record, could you please restate the specific question?
Vice Chair McCabe.
Thanks, so Ms. Glover, through the chair, I'm just, I'm curious what is covered, what would be covered under this bill? It's a property tax. So I guess it's just property, has nothing to do with oil production. So it's not any part of a severance tax or any of that kind of thing. And also, as long as we're on the subject and you're answering the question, if you wouldn't mind a second question about the pipeline and the property that goes through the unorganized borough and how much the state of Alaska gets from that portion of our current property tax.
For the record, again, Colleen Glover, Tax Division Director. So, correct, this bill only is specific to the oil and gas property tax, which is assessed on a statewide level. It does have secondary impact on the production tax. Now, on the fiscal note, you can see because any upstream property tax is a lease expenditure on production tax, so it can reduce production taxes. So on the fiscal note, you can see there's kind of a negative impact on general fund because of the reduction in production tax. So they are related. And there could be also some impact on a corporate income tax, depending on the taxpayer, too. The property tax could be an allowable deduction on corporate income tax. We don't have that included in the fiscal note. As far as, and I think the discussion on impact to local boroughs from this change, it's, as stated, it's all of this incremental tax only goes to the state. There's no direct revenue to the locals. But I think some helpful information is to understand of the whole oil and gas property tax base, how much is for the different boroughs. We do have information in our fall revenue sources book that has this, but just for the unorganized area, for last year's property tax made up 11%. So all of that unorganized area, about 11% of the kind of taxable tax base, that goes 100% to the state. North Slope Borough was 73% of the tax base, and the Kenai Peninsula Borough, or Cook Inlet, is 5% of the tax base. So those entities in those areas would have an increased property tax. I think that gets to the question about how it could impact the Cook Inlet producers. But the Kenai area is 5% of the tax base. Valdez is 7%. Very small amounts. And the Matsu Borough, Whittier has a small amount. Cordova has a very small amount. And same with Anchorage.
Thank you.
What's it?
I just got another question.
Representative Henshute, you had raised your hand earlier. Do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, through the chair. I think, first of all, thank you to Representative Groh for being creative in how we might solve our structural deficit problem. And I'm not sure who previously said this, but I would like to see this in the context of the full package of how we, I think it was Representative Ruffridge, the full package of how we tax oil. So if there's no property tax on oil installations in another state, do they have a different per barrel? So I just have a weak understanding of that. And so I'm not sure if we would ask Representative Groh or if I go and do my own research, but I'd like to understand this bill in the context of the full package of how Alaska taxes our oil industry, and maybe then compare that to what other states do. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Henshute, and through the chair, I would say that's the kind of question that Colleen Glover, the director of the tax division, could also address. But just briefly, obviously, as you allude to, Representative Henshute, there's various oil and gas states in which there's oil and gas production, have a suite or packages of taxes. Of which the oil and gas property tax may or may not be one of them. Obviously, it is in Alaska. And I would also note, as a matter of the fiscal note, before we go to Ms. Glover, I would hope that that's what I usually say, because of the involvement of other taxes and other trade-offs Ms. Glover referenced, that this is probably on the order of $250 million a year to the state. That there's additional revenue, but like I said, there are some other factors. It's definitely, however, a net winner or a net positive for the state in terms of the revenues, even with those other factors as you described. As I said, Mr. Chair, she could describe other taxes that oil and gas taxes the state has, and if she chose to, what other states have.
Ms. Glover, would you like to speak to that?
Colleen Glover, for the record, Tax Division Director. There's a few different taxes that the state imposes on oil and gas producers. There's the oil and gas production tax. There's an oil and gas property tax that the state administers on a statewide level. local municipalities can assess and take that as a credit against the state portion. There is a corporate income tax for qualifying entities. And then there's also the royalty component. There's a lot of other details that go behind each of those programs. There's actually a really good presentation that is usually done every year. There's one done in House Finance called the Order Operations that was done on February 9th. That would be a really good resource to go look at that presentation or listen to that hearing. It really walks through all the calculations for and how that works. As far as other states, we are not an expert in that. If that's something, I mean, we could look into and follow up. The challenge is trying to do an apples-to-apples comparison on statewide because they are different. It depends on landowner ownership. If sometimes, you know, there's local property tax and not a statewide tax. So, you know, in a state that doesn't have a statewide property tax, but each local jurisdiction is taxing differently, there's just a lot that goes into trying to research that, and we are definitely not experts in other state tax policies. But if there's a specific request to look into that, we can get back to you on that.
Representative Grove.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would note that, as I said before, the oil and gas property tax is a much more stable form of revenue for the state. It's actually growing as a percentage of the, has been growing, even staying at the same rate. It's been growing as a percentage of the oil and gas revenues because the production tax revenues have been so unstable and have been incredibly volatile. And obviously over time have dropped a lot because of both the drop in the value of the volume of oil production in Alaska and the fact that oil prices can't stay high enough and to make compensate and bounce all over. You know, other proposals have been put out to reduce the corporate income tax rate, which is a big part of what oil and gas companies pay in Alaska. They're big payers under that tax. So this, like I said, I want to stress this is a stable form of revenue for the state. And a more predictable source of revenue in a time when we face, as I said, a massive and growing structural deficit.
Representative McKay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have several comments. First of all, Alaska is very difficult to compare to other states because we are unique in that all of our subsurface oil and gas reserves are publicly owned. In Texas, Oklahoma, many other states, it's all mostly under private ownership. We could be possibly compared to the Gulf of Mexico for Texas and Louisiana, which would be within the three-mile limit, would be state-owned. So it's very difficult to go apples and apples, Alaska, to compare to other states. Oil and gas properties include platforms, wells, gravel roads, gravel pads, production facilities, all the major production facilities that you see in the North Slope pipelines, all of that is considered oil and gas property and is assessed, I think, annually, just like your house is in town. And the value of that property is then used to determine the existing property tax that they now pay. If we're looking at adding on $250 million a year against the industry, it says right in the fiscal note analysis for this bill under the revenue impact, excuse me, first paragraph, the revenue impact of this bill is estimated and assumes no changes to company behavior or investment from the assumptions in the forecast. So right there is a huge mistake, because if you take $250 million out of our oil-producing private sector, they will change their behavior. They will change their investment decisions. We're already having an extremely difficult time attracting investment up here. We only have a handful of companies operating. We've lost several companies, and we're just disincentivizing further activity in our private sector. Furthermore, in the last paragraph under revenue impact section, it says, in addition to property tax and production tax, royalty revenue would also be impacted by this bill and is not addressed in this fiscal note. So there's another huge open question that needs to be studied. So I would suggest, with all due respect, this is an incomplete bill, an incomplete fiscal note analysis, and we need to do a lot more study about what the impact would be if this were to pass into law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grove.
I think I would say 2 points. Through the chair, Representative McCabe's comments have to be weighed against, as they keep saying, the massive structural deficit the state faces and the actual choices that we face, what we're going to do to provide good roads, good schools, good public safety for the people of Alaska. That these revenues, the current revenues under this tax help provide, and the additional revenues could provide more of, given that our current fiscal circumstances. Additionally, I do think that another committee perhaps could look at this question. That Mr. Representative McCabe has raised, but I do want to stress that, as I said before, this is a stable source of revenue, and a predictable cost for the oil industry in a time when they said they're looking for more certainty, and a way to help address this massive deficit that our state does confront.
Vice Chair McCabe.
Thank you. So just a comment. I wonder if our structural deficit in the state is because we have driven the oil companies, the major oil companies, out of state by our sort of willy-nilly tax procedures. Every time we seem to have a little bit of a fiscal burp, we turn to the oil companies to fix it. And I think that especially as far as investment, so property tax disincentivizes investment. Why would you build a $30 million oil platform that's going to pull oil out of the ground for years and years, when you could build a $10 million platform and just get the majority of the well out instead of a stripper well, or planning on a stripper well later or whatever. So point being is, our structural deficit, I think, in large part is caused by the way that we have treated the oil companies. They're not a piggy bank. Oil's it's not a revenue stream. It's a fixed asset. And we need to understand that the more we disincentivize them from investing in Alaska and from producing oil in Alaska, the bigger our structural deficit is going to become. So we're kind of down this path where we're creating our own problems, in just Kevin's opinion, sort of, but I appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Himishu.
Thank you, through the chair. The point about needing to study things is well taken. I wasn't following things a few years ago, but it seems like we gave a favorable break to the companies, the oil companies, and within a year BP pulled out of Alaska after we'd given a more favorable situation to them. I don't know how much that was studied. How would we trigger a study on this idea? I think it's worthy of a study. Is that something that we amend this bill to study it, or how, did we study the decision that was made that resulted in BP leaving the state even after we gave them something favorable? Had we studied that, and what were the findings? So I guess I'm throwing out into the universe, if this needs to be studied, how do we make that happen? So I don't know if that's the question for Representative Groh.
Mr. Chair, happy if the committee wants to include a study in this bill. I would note that this legislation helps provide, it's a fixed cost, so it provides more certainty, and certainty is an attractive feature for investment, from everything that I have learned. And additionally, I would say that Representative Himshute is correct in the sense that the state has made some moves, some would say contortions, and efforts to try to make the state more attractive for oil and gas investment. That has not always worked out the way the state thought at the time that those laws were passed to do that. And additionally, in reference to Representative McCabe's comments, that the state hitched its wagon or made a giant reliance on oil and moved away from and eliminated the state's only broad-based tax, repealed it in 1980. That's a big factor given the way oil production's declined and oil prices have not risen enough to compensate for that, for why we were today. And I would also note that Senate Bill 21, a reduction in oil taxes in the new system that we gained then, preceded the decline, further declines in oil production that we have. So I do think the state's got to look out for itself and look out for the people of Alaska in terms of provision of the services that, like I described before, in terms of schools, roads, public safety, public health, and others. And this would be one of more than one step that would need to be taken to help confront, like I said, this massive structural deficit that keeps growing on us.
Are there any other comments? Representative McKay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You've given me a lot of time, and I appreciate it. I have to let one comment that Representative Groh has made cannot go unchallenged. SB 21 actually retarded the decline, and over the past two or three years, we've actually seen a increase in production coming off the North Slope. So I think that our tax policies are working now. We have stability, and this would disturb that stability greatly. In response to Representative Himshut's question, the legislature does have the capacity, if they want to spend the money, to hire consultants, and they can do studies, and they can tell you what they think will happen. And if the oil companies are willing, they would even testify and tell you what they will do if they're willing to do that. And so we're not like blind, and we do have history. We absolutely know what happened every time we raised oil taxes over decades. I was involved in some of those, the consequences of those actions, which resulted in rigs being laid down, people losing their jobs, and production declines. And that was as a result of the famous ELF debate in 1989. And then, of course, the famous ACES law, which retarded production on the slope and probably deferred Willow by several years. And wouldn't we like to have Willow right now? You see, if Willow was on production right now, like it should be, we wouldn't be having a deficit. So this is how it works. We have to, Mr. Chairman, you've given me a lot of time. I appreciate it. We have to be very careful about the taxation of our state's biggest industry. That's what I'm trying to say. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the time.
Sure. Absolutely. Is there any more remarks before we conclude? Some some comments that I have. I think it's important to be cognizant, I think, of the different elements of our state and what makes up our oil tax structure. But I think I would still like to see just a comparison. I think that information would be good. I think we kind of talked about that in this meeting, but I don't really feel like I got the answer I was looking for. And so if we could get just some sort of comparison, I think that would be really good information for us. And I guess just to Representative Himshut's request for a study, I appreciate the idea, but I just do worry about spending money on a study like that. I think there's information available that we can kind of glean from past choices already, and so commissioning a study might not really be necessary. So I guess I would maybe charge Representative Groh with maybe just looking at some of that and providing some of that information. I think that would be really helpful for us. So those are just the comments that I had. Representative Groh, Mr. Ebersold, thank you for bringing this legislation to the committee today. And
HB 153 will be held over. Next week, we will be meeting at our regular time on Tuesday and Thursday. The time is 9:31 a.m. and this hearing of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee is now adjourned.